37. There was no Allied reaction to Hitler's resignation from the League of Nations or to German rearmament, which from this moment onward was demonstratively pursued, though it was still occasionally denied in speeches. In the following days, I experienced that blend of cowardly relief and deep disappointment that would become the common feeling of the next few years for me and those like me. It was repeated ad nauseam and made life wearisome. These days marked the beginning of our ideological training. It took a remarkably indirect and subtle form. We had been prepared for lectures, speeches, and interrogations in the guise of discussion groups. None of that occurred. Instead, on the Monday, we were given proper uniforms, grey, blousy uniforms, rather like the ones worn by the Russians in the Great War, with caps, belts, and shoulder straps. In this military gear, we tramped around the barracks yard, our only duty being to take the written law examinations, marshal, field grey examinees. Once that was over, something began that was called drill. Superficially, it was a little like military drill, the more so since our superiors, S.A. Sturmführers and the like, deliberately employed the classical tone of army sergeant majors. However, we received no weapons training. We exercised a bit and were taught to march and salute. Saluting occupied a full morning in the following manner. We formed up in threes. At a command, each row in turn marched forward. The platoon leader, as he was officially called, marched backward a few steps in front of and to one side of the row, checking posture and alignment. Suddenly the platoon leader would bark, "Heil Hitler!" in a voice like an exploding bomb. At that, the three men had simultaneously to snap their left thumbs under their shoulder straps, spreading the other fingers of that hand, thrust out their right arms so that the tips of the fingers of the right hand were exactly at eye level, and jerk their heads to the left. Then, after mentally counting 2, 3, they had to bellow, "Heil Hitler, platoon leader!" in perfect unison again, as loudly as an exploding bomb. If it was not satisfactory, the whole procedure was repeated with the order, "Repeat! Quick march!" Otherwise it was the next row's turn, and the three who had just finished had no more to do for 10 minutes, until it was their turn again. This lasted 2 or 3 hours. Or we just marched around the countryside for 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours. These marches had no aim or recognizable purpose. While we were marching, we sang. There were 3 kinds of songs, which we were taught in lessons in the afternoons and sang on these marches. The first were S.A. songs, literary constructs of the type that shop assistants sometimes send into local papers. Usually they contained dire threats against the Jews, combined with sentiments like "the last few rays of the golden setting sun," and so on. Then there were infantry songs from the last war. Gentle, sentimental bits of nonsense, richly provided with obscene variants, but not lacking a certain balladesque charm. Finally, there were strange lansquenet songs, in which we might declare that we were Gaia's black band and would put a red cock on the monastery hall. Florian Gaia was a leader of the peasants' uprising of 1525. These songs were the most popular, and were more ruggedly and more fiercely sung than the others. I am certain that at least half these German referendars and future judges, marching through the surroundings of Protestant Jüterbog, really felt as though they were Gaia's black band, and would put a red cock on the monastery hall. Like children absorbed in a game, they sang these songs with wild delight, sounding like a troop of club-carrying ancient Germanic tribesmen. Their gruff voices roared, "Lord on high, we cry to you, hey-ho, hey-ho, to death the clergy we shall do, hey-ho, hey-ho, up and at them one and all, put a red cock on the monastery hall." Of course I sang along. We all sang along. That was the sum of our ideological training. By acceding to the rules of the game that was being played with us, we automatically changed, not quite into Nazis, but certainly into usable Nazi material. Why, then, did we accede to them? There were a whole bunch of reasons, some major and some minor, some mitigating and some aggravating. The most superficial one was that we wanted to pass our examinations, and that this had become a requirement to do so. Certainly the mysterious hints that the camp report would play a major part in determining the outcome of the examinations, and that weak performance in the written papers could be compensated for by keenness in marching and singing must have increased the motivation of some of us. It was more decisive that we had been caught completely off guard, and had had no idea of what would be done with us, or how to resist it. Mutiny? Simply leaving the camp and going home? That would have needed to be organized, and, under a thin coat of rough and hearty camp comradeship, we all mistrusted one another deeply. Finally, there was a typically German aspiration that began to influence us strongly, although we hardly noticed it. This was the idolization of proficiency for its own sake, the desire to do whatever you are assigned to do as well as it can possibly be done. However senseless, meaningless, or downright humiliating it may be, it should be done as efficiently, thoroughly, and faultlessly as could be imagined. So we should clean lockers, sing, and march? Well, we would clean them better than any professional cleaner. We would march like campaign veterans, and we would sing so ruggedly that the trees bent over. This idolization of proficiency for its own sake is a German vice. The Germans think it is a German virtue. In any case, it is deeply ingrained in the German character. We could not help ourselves. We are the worst saboteurs in the world. If we do something, it has to be done scrupulously. The voices of conscience and self-respect are powerless against this attitude. We find a deep, numbing, sinful pleasure in doing anything, be it a decent and important job, a wild adventure, or a crime, as well as can be. This feeling robs us of the ability to think about the significance of what we are doing. Faced with a particularly thoroughly and methodically burgled house, a policeman may say admiringly, "That's a first-class piece of work." That was our weakest point, whether we were Nazis or not. That was the point they attacked with remarkable psychological and strategic insight. It came into full effect only when after 1 or 2 weeks the training personnel was changed. The SA Sturmführers, who had been in charge of us so far, left to go for further training in some camp themselves. In their place there appeared a lieutenant of the Reichswehr with 12 petty officers. One morning this attractive young man suddenly appeared just as we had formed up for a march in the pouring rain. "What dismal faces you're all making," he said, "in such glorious weather, and with such a satisfying occupation." That had a friendly, human sound. He even used the formal Z. He left us in no doubt about his opinion of the SA in general, and our previous SA leaders in particular. The petty officers were even more outspoken. "Now we're going to do something sensible here," declared Corporal Schmidt that very afternoon, as he took charge of our platoon. We were handed rifles, and were quickly taught their 7 component parts, and then how to use them. That was a real relief. Now we really were recruits, and we were inclined to view that as an improvement. At least we knew what was going on, and what we were supposed to be learning. The implicit general humiliation of doing senseless things, whose purpose was unfathomable all day long, was over. How glad we were! Our ideological training really was already taking effect. There is a saying ascribed to Hitler, "I will press my opponents into service in the Reichswehr."